All right. Good morning, everybody. I'll ask the marshal to go ahead and call the first case.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Schmidt, Judge Sleater, Judge Klophockey, the Honorable Judge Schmidt presiding.
Good morning, everybody. If you are not presenting, please go ahead and mute yourself. And the person who is presenting, you can go ahead and stay unmuted. The appellant will have 15 minutes for argument. Respondent will have 15 minutes in response, followed by 5 minutes of rebuttal for the appellant's attorney. The argument will be recorded. Only an audio will be available later. So today is March 6th. And I'm John Schmidt. I'm presiding today here with Judges Sleater and Judge Klophockey. And so with that, we'll ask appellant, you can start when you're ready, go ahead and unmute and your 15 minutes will begin. And you have the clock should be right on your screen there, which will be counting down your time.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is attorney Mark Kelly, and I'm here representing the appellant, Timothy Wells. Mr. Wells is here to request that this court reverse the district court's commitment of Mr. Wells to the Commissioner of Corrections for a period of 117 months as a result of technical violations accumulated over time of his previously stayed sentence. I've raised two issues in my appellate brief for this court's consideration. The first issue is whether or not the district court abused its discretion in refusing to grant the appellant's request for a post-conviction evidentiary hearing in response to the petition that was filed when this direct appeal was stayed by order of this court to permit the processing of that post-conviction petition. The case law that we've cited in our memorandum, in our appellate brief.
Mr. Wells, could I interrupt you? I'm sorry. I wanted to jump actually to the issue. You have the second issue first, then we come back to the first one. A part of the question, first question I have with regard to the abuse you allege in terms of revoking probation is the second Austin factor. And but I see from the record your client admitted to the violation based on four separate positive chemical use tests, or at least his admission that he'd used on four different occasions. So doesn't that really render resolved the second issue? So really is only a third Austin factor that we need to consider your arguments upon?
Well, there are certainly grounds to... I think that the whole argument is somewhat circular and the one depends on the other. What we really needed to do to put our best case forward was to develop the record with regard to facts which were not known to the district court and not a part of the record at the time the decision was rendered on January 17th, 2023. So we were trying to develop, I guess, two different new facts, if you will, or new arguments. One was regarding ineffective assistance of counsel, but the other was to establish that, in fact, the agent that was monitoring my client on a day-to-day basis, Agent Robinson, was in possession of documentation that the district court didn't have. His attorney, his public defender at the hearing didn't have, and that apparently the agent that was recommending prison didn't have.
I see that argument, but maybe I'll just pose the question differently. Your client does not disagree that his failure to abstain from methamphetamine use was a violation of probation, and that he admitted to. So what you're referring to is both the Strickland standard and the third prong, whether it was inappropriate to execute, but he's not denying he violated probation, correct?
That is correct. And he did that not only directly to his agent, but also in court. But you know, once again, the fact that there's a sufficiency there, the appellant would respectfully submit, is a far cry from being a justification, right? I mean, there's a prerequisite, perhaps, to finding a violation, which my client admitted. But under the statute, applicable statute, it's a technical violation. And this person has gone 7 years without committing any major violation. He never, you know, absconding or committing a new crime. 7 years with no allegation that he failed to maintain contact or committed a new crime. And I note that while it's...
You suggested that the record could establish a justification, but the standard isn't here whether there would be some justification. Standard here is whether there was an abuse of discretion, isn't it?
Yeah, and the abuse of discretion standard, that's correct, Judge Klopaki. The abuse of discretion is in denying, first off, our request for that evidentiary hearing to fully develop the record. And then once again, use that new fully developed facts to establish that the third prong for Austin wasn't met. So without the evidentiary hearing, the record once again was only contains my affidavit in support of my petition for post-conviction relief.
Did you make an offer of proof to the court as to what these items that were missing would establish?
Yes, so my affidavit in support of my petition for post-conviction relief specifically states that following my initial consultation with my client, where he said, you know, the judge put me in prison because he said after my last use, I didn't address my treatment needs, but I had already done an assessment, finished treatment, and sent that to my agent in October of 2022. And if you go to the record, so there's two parts of the record I want to point to the court. First off, my affidavit indicates I have spoken, Attorney Kelly has spoken to Agent Robinson, and if called to testify, he would confirm receipt of an updated chemical use assessment in compliance with the recommendations for outpatient treatment in October of 2022. Now, juxtapose that with what's in the record of that transcript of that hearing on January 17th on page 67. This is toward the end of the hearing where the district court has decided that he has to put my client in prison for 117 months for the failed UA. And he specifically says that he credits my client for being very sincere and motivated. My client, I think very eloquently, indicated that this is a disease that never goes away, but can only be treated. And so then, and the need for him to be sober and the desire for him to be sober. But the district court on page 67 says, I cannot ignore the track record and the history before this court. Specifically, regarding use just this past October, he's referenced, that's referenced in the report. And he and a failure of treatment and the recency of use in October. And then when I asked your attorney, Mr. Wells, what rehabilitative measures have you taken since then? And your attorney has nothing.
That isn't that supported by the record, meaning indeed the judge asked your client a number of times what he's done since October, since the last failed test. Now, he said nothing. And moreover, even if we were to assume he had a chemical assessment, that doesn't mean he's attended treatment. So what's the abuse of discretion, or on your first issue, how do you overcome the prejudice prong when the same judge addressed both and said it was based on the years of failing to remain sober? And that was the sole basis upon which he executed. And of course, that's a critical condition of a controlled substance probation.
My affidavit in support of my petition for post-conviction relief referenced this conversation with Agent Robinson. What Agent Robinson, and I tried to do it as succinctly as I could, was going to testify to was that he didn't know about this document he had received verifying completion of treatment in late October. He didn't even know. And I said, my client sent it to you. It's in your file. Look for it. He looked for it. He
said, what I'm getting at, Mr. Kelly, is the judge was aware of that by the time your client's post-conviction petition. In other words, the judge said specifically the allegation or violation was admitted use following any treatment he would have completed. So how do you overcome the second prong of Strickland given that part of the record?
I think that the court was wholly unaware at the time that the court sent my client to prison that he had verified recent completion of treatment. So was Agent Gunkel, who I think the record should reflect. I mean, Agent Gunkel never met with my client once. He just appeared at court. He never monitored my client. Agent Robinson monitored my client on a weekly basis. Now, once again, when I'm going to go to the mat over 117 months, one of my arguments was clearly in my petition for post-conviction relief. If my client is telling me that my day-to-day agent has proof of completion of treatment, and the agent who's sending me to prison says he hasn't completed treatment recently, right? That I need to call time out and get that document. Why don't I have that document? And I think that it's clear from the record, not only did the state was unaware that my client had completed treatment in October, and the court was unaware that my client had completed treatment
in October. So your offer was, when did he complete the treatment? When in October?
I believe it was late. I believe that he finished in late October because the assessment.
And when was this last claimed violation? Before or after that date?
I believe that he had a failed UA after that date.
After he completed treatment.
I believe that he did have an admission of use. I don't know if it was a UA, but I think he admitted use.
And the trial court sort of focused on that fact, did it not? That after all the treatment you've had, you still are violating.
Certainly, there's failures with the disease, and that was relied upon by the court. The question, once again, when it goes back to is the need to confine my client, right, outweighed by the policies favoring probation? And this goes to my second argument. That the court was kind of going in earlier on. You know, I think this is certainly developing over time how we approach as a society, how we approach the disease of chemical dependency. But if somebody is not lying about their use and somebody is not absconding from probation and somebody is asking for and seeking medical treatment for chemical dependency, do we benefit from incarcerating them for 117 months versus continuing them on probation?
Your client's prior treatment programs, I gather they were all outpatient programs, were they?
I believe he had been to inpatient treatment prior. But you're talking about a period of 7 years, Your Honor, and you know, there was extended periods of sobriety followed by slips and then back to treatment. It's anecdotal, but under today's rules, he's only on paper for 5 years. He's not even facing this violation, somewhat aside. But, you know, this is once again, we're taking a different look at these long, long probationary periods where there's going to be with a chemically dependent person technical violations over time. I think from a perspective of as much as it is man hours put into monitoring, I think that the benefit of someone who's not absconding, who's asking for help, is not committing new crimes, and is admitting, not lying, admitting when he fails and uses.
Mr. Gilligan, go ahead.
One of the problems here, that when he's out on his own, he can't stay away from the drugs. So maybe he needs to be in a setting where he can't get at the drugs. That plus treatment maybe can turn him around, because that's the only thing that hasn't been tried up to this point.
Well, and that's certainly the approach that the court seemed to take.
What's wrong with that approach? Otherwise, does this go on forever?
I understand, but I still feel like this is a little bit of bootstrapping of the third prong of Austin. My best argument on appeal is that my client should have been granted an evidentiary hearing to develop these facts. And without justification, my client's ability to develop those facts was hindered by two things. First off, he didn't have enough time to produce the evidence for his.
Counsel, I think you unmuted there for a sec.
I apologize. First off, he didn't have enough, apparently, preparation from his court-appointed counsel. But secondly, on the petition for post-conviction relief, we just wanted the district court, the record, I should say, to have all the facts.
Well, let's assume that all those facts had been before the district court, and the district court came with the same conclusion. Would it be an abuse of discretion?
Well, once again, I think that this reminds me of the Copy case, which is a completely different issue, but it's what would the jury have done with the correct statement of law? I mean, you know, like what would the district court have done when you read the record on page 67 and you see what the district court is thinking? How could anyone conclusively determine that with the fact that my client had sought treatment and finished treatment and verified that to his agent, that the district court would have reached a different conclusion? And it's just a different poker hand. How would the cards have been played? We don't know. All we know for sure is that my attempt to develop that hand was cut off. And the case law says that I get that evidentiary hearing if I've established that, that once again, assuming that the facts that are in my affidavit are true, right? Should we have been granted that evidentiary hearing? We don't argue about what the record does or doesn't show relative to what's alleged in my petition, actually. And based on what's alleged in my petition for post-conviction relief, I should have been granted that evidentiary hearing. That, I think, is the salient issue that we're asking this court to do.
And counsel, I see your time is up. Gave you a little extra time there because of the muting issue, and we'll move to respondents counsel. You'll have 15 minutes for your argument, and you can unmute and proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court. My name is Jackie Fogle, and I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this matter. Now, it appears everyone is very familiar with the facts of this case, so I won't go through and just recite my entire brief, but do want to hit on a few points that were just highlighted by counsel and some questions that were presented by the court. I would agree that because the defendant did admit to the violations at the probation violation hearing, that the first two factors under Austin would be satisfied. So hinging on whether or not the state abused its discretion in regards to the third factor, in showing that the need for confinement outweighs the policies favoring probation.
If counsel's representation of what he wanted to present at an evidentiary hearing were true, are you saying that no way that would affect the court's exercise of discretion in this matter?
Your Honor, I don't believe that it would have hindered the court's ability to exercise its discretion. I think especially in cases where...
How do we know what a trial court would have done with information that it didn't have?
Your Honor, I think the court did make clear findings in the transcript in regards to the Austin factors. He did inquire with defendant whether or not he had been to treatment, because there was some testimony regarding the defendant attending some treatment program in Hawaii. And it was also addressed in the court's order denying the petition for post-conviction relief, where it appeared that reference to treatment was a previous treatment program, which was included 12 outpatient, I believe, sessions in Hawaii. And this was all completed before the last, which was the fifth violation, and the addendum that we're following. Those tests were from October 26th of 2022 and November 3rd of 2022. So after the appellant would have been completed treatment. So I think that the court could have still used its discretion even after, even if the court did have records or other documentation showing that previous treatment program, I don't believe it would have impacted that. And I think that is stated in the court's order going through his reasoning for concluding that, well, the but-for analysis under Strickland.
Ms. Vogel, before you get into that, to follow up Judge Klapke's question, in looking at the judge's memorandum denying post-conviction relief, it does look like, and this maybe is what you're referring to, the judge refers to that information about his most recent treatment in Hawaii being in one of the, I think it was in the probation violation report of October 28, and that's the 12 individual sessions you're referring to. And the judge went on to say, the report goes on to state that petitioner began treatment in Hawaii on 4/10/22 and successfully completed the treatment as of 8/24/22. And then the judge writes to suggest that Agent Gunkel and or the court was not fully updated or aware of petitioner's treatment history or assessment is not supported. There, I'm paraphrasing. So is that what you're referring to? And that suggests to me the judge had that information at the time of sentencing because it was in the pre-sentence investigation or in the probation violation report, which the court acknowledged reviewing. Is that a fair summary of the record?
That is, Your Honor. Thank you. I think the section that you had mentioned, the court didn't believe that it would have changed or impacted his decision. I don't believe that the documentation would have changed showing that the defendant would have been amenable to probation. I think he goes through a pretty thorough analysis in his order denying the petition for post-conviction relief. Did I answer your question, Judge? Or did it?
Yes, you did. Thank you. Yes. What I wanted to just clarify, are you presuming, because maybe that's all we can do at this point, that the treatment that the appellant's referring to that purports not to be before the judge was that treatment, and it actually was before the judge at the time of sentencing?
And I believe so. I believe that is the case.
I noticed as well that the trial court said couldn't understand everything that was writing with him and his family, that he did not engage in rehabilitation after this relapse in October. And as my understanding here, the appellant's counsel is suggesting that the information that would come out if he had an evidentiary hearing would not relate to any new rehabilitation activity after that October relapse. Is my understanding correct here?
And that was my understanding. I don't believe that there was anything done afterwards. And I think
he went from October to the hearing in what, January, and did nothing?
Correct. Well, and even the probation violation hearing, December 15th of 22, and then the disposition hearing was, yes, the January 17th court date. And defendant had not. He had been clear about that when asked about if he had done anything proactively since the violation. He had not. I had questioned him, had he gone to a single meeting? He had said no. Had he done any treatment since his relapses? He said no. I asked him if he'd done anything proactively since being in Hawaii, and he said no.
And normally when we have a treatment program, there's some continuing aftercare required. We don't know what those requirements were, and apparently whatever they were, he didn't engage in any of them. Is that what the record reflects?
It does. I don't believe that if this was a 12-session outpatient program, I don't know if there were any recommendations following that. I do know that he had not completed any programming or any I guess, work on his own end to do anything to, I guess, ensure his sobriety, whether it be meetings, whether it be completing an updated chemical use assessment. Doesn't appear that appellant had done anything. I think that was significant in the court's decision. He actually inquired with the defendant quite a bit, asking him about if he had done anything, trying to clarify. I think it's clear that Judge Malley's decision to revoke probation was not reflexive or knee-jerk reaction. I believe he sincerely was hoping that appellant would have given him some information that possibly would have shown he'd be amenable. As I stated earlier, this was a case where appellant received a downward dispositional departure of the 117-month sentence when he was sentenced. And he was granted this departure because there was the belief that he was particularly amenable to probation. However, his history on probation showed quite differently. During his time on probation, there were 5 probation violation reports filed, which also had following them 6 different addendum reports. Of those 11 reports, there were 15 different alleged violations. 8 of these violations were relating to the use of methamphetamine, and actually included several instances of use in each of the violations. I believe the last one referenced, or the October 28 report, that mentioned 3 different incidents of use. There was one violation for failing to remain law-abiding, 1 for leaving the state of Minnesota without agent's approval, 2 for failing to complete treatment as he was directed, 2 for failing to submit to testing as he was directed.
Ms. Fogel, could I inquire there, a little bit of a strange procedure here in that his supervising agent apparently, I don't know if he said it or I think he told the non-supervising transfer agent, they call it, which was the community corrections in Crow Wing County, but apparently the agent who was supervising him is in Clearwater at Department of Corrections, apparently has a policy that even though he's the one doing the supervising and makes files of the report, that he's prohibited from giving a recommendation, which I understand was part of the reason the judge found the second Strickland standard not met, because the judge wasn't going to get a recommendation one way or the other. But did I say that correctly? And are you familiar with why that would be? That seems a bit odd from my personal experience on the district bench. Whoever was supervising would give me a recommendation along with the report and would be the one testifying, even if they're located in a different county.
Well, in your honor, in this case, it's not uncommon to have the Crow Wing County, the transferring agent, testify. They, as Agent Gunkel testified to, he kept in contact with the supervising agent from Clearwater County. And actually, defendant was in Hawaii almost the entire time. He did come back, I believe it was approximately monthly, from Hawaii to have some contact with the Clearwater agent. But it's not uncommon for the supervising agents to defer recommendations to the originating agent, which in this case was Crow Wing County. And I think the court also relied on the narrative that was provided by Agent Robinson out of Clearwater, and did note even that in his report, while he was deferring recommendations, he did also make a statement, something along the lines of, this agent doesn't know what more can be done to help the defendant, address his use of methamphetamine. So I think he's aware. He considered that. He stated in his order denying post-conviction relief that he took this as a statement from someone who is not arguing that this individual is particularly amenable to probation. And I think the court relied on the narrative that he provided. He reviewed all of the violation reports and did note that, as the state noted in its brief, Agent Robinson had never appeared at a previous violation hearing. The last two probation or contested disposition hearings, where the state and probation both were recommending that probation be revoked and the sentence executed. Both of those times, it was just based on the testimony of the Crow Wing County agent. No Clearwater agent had ever appeared in previous hearings, whether or not they were contested. So similar situation to the one at hand. Did I answer that question, or would you like me to?
No, that's fine. Yeah, you did. Thank you. I didn't know. It sounds like you're familiar with that process. And it sounded like it was also some sort of a protocol between Department of Corrections and Community Corrections situation based on what I saw.
And if that's the case, I'm not aware of it. I know that very often they will defer to the originating agency. So that's not uncommon. And it sounded like in reviewing the testimony of Agent Gunkel, he was very familiar with the case. He had regular contact with Agent Robinson. He was aware of previous treatment attempts. He had stated, I believe, on at the contested disposition hearing that he thought he had five, where a defendant had claimed that he had at least 10 treatment attempts in his lifetime. So I think all of those factors were considered by the court.
And the quote you're referring to, I think the judge read it the same way you're presenting it, that was in reference to what more could be done in relation to remaining sober because of that history of treatment and then a history of use after treatment's completed.
Yes. And I think it is, it's important to keep in mind defendants. I mean, he seemed, yes, he had admitted. He had, I think on all of his previous violations, he had accepted responsibility, admitted the violations. However, in reviewing his testimony, I think there's an undertone where he very much believes that he should be able to commit any violation. And as long as he admits it, which I believe Mr. Kelly just alluded to as well, that he wasn't lying, he admitted. So that should be, supporting the court, reinstating him on probation. That isn't the case. And I believe that's exactly why the judge relied on the fact that it would unduly depreciate the seriousness of the violation. He did state he didn't find the defendant was amenable to probation, but I think he did, in looking at the sheer number of violations, that it would unduly depreciate. And even the appellant or defendant during his testimony at the disposition hearing, he made several statements about, yes, I mess up. I have a disease. It's you can't cure it. While, some of that might be true, I think he lacks self-awareness. And that he stated, looking back, hindsight, I should have taken the deal for 33 months and then just went and did prison time and be done with it.
Did the appellant at the sentencing hearing have any proposal to the trial court as to what he would do going forward if he were back on probation? What I mean do in terms of rehabilitation so that he wouldn't keep abusing.
Well, I think he said at some point he would be willing to do whatever, but I think he also in the same breath admitted that he was going to be messing up and using again. I don't think that he ever said, I will never use again. I think, very much expected that this was going to happen again. And I think I had presented that during my argument at the hearing, is that I believe we would be here.
Does the attorney have any plan for what the rehabilitation would look like?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Did his attorney have any plan that he described as to what the rehabilitation program would look like into the future?
I think there was not specifically. I think they had mentioned that he could continue coming back. He would be willing to travel back and forth to Minnesota, would be willing to meet with his agents. But in regards to having a specific treatment plan outlined or knowing where he would go, there was nothing presented to the court in regards to that. A lot of the focus was on him wanting to, you know, stay out of custody so that he could care for his wife. It seemed a lot of the focus was on that.
And counsel, I see your time is wrapped up here.
That was way too short. Thank you.
Appreciate your argument. And appellant's counsel, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Go ahead and unmute, and you can go ahead when you're ready.
Regarding the comment from Agent Robinson in his report that was cited by the court in denying my petition for a hearing on post-conviction relief, this agent does not know what else can be done. This was done without knowledge that my client had completed treatment. I can affirm that, and I did under oath, because when I spoke to Agent Robinson, he told me, I knew your client was going to treatment. Your client never completed treatment, and he never explained to me why he didn't. And then I said
doesn't the record reflect, though, that between the time of the violation in October and the time for the probation violation hearing and or the sentencing, your client did nothing towards rehabilitation in that period of time?
Yes. So is
that an accurate reflection of the record?
It is, but with a little different context. When Agent Robinson was unaware that my client had verified completion of treatment.
But you're talking about verification of treatment before this last violation. The point that the trial court made, and that I'm trying to make, is trial court says, I'm at a loss as to why you haven't engaged in anything more since then, I mean, in October. And he didn't suggest that he had engaged in any kind of treatment program in that time period.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I believe the record reflects a little different context to that, if I can just explain. Page 27 of the record, my client is on the stand. And the question is about the assessment being done in spring of 2022. And then, but the question from the court to my client, but since testing positive in November 2022, you haven't done any treatment. This is on page 27. So what happens is there's a violation report that's sent to the court by Agent Robinson and through Agent Gunkel. And there's a warrant put out for my client's arrest so that he has to leave Hawaii, come back here for an admit-deny hearing. And Agent Robinson is in possession of the completion of treatment, but he doesn't know it. And so he believes my client has not verified completion of treatment. Now, when my client comes back to the state of Minnesota in late November, I believe it is, he has use, but no positive UA. He actually calls his agent and says, I'm going to test positive. But that's late November. I think that's late November after he's already been revoked. So the question from the court is, since testing positive in November 2022, you haven't done any treatment. And my client affirms that's true. So once again, I think that all these facts would have been established had we had our evidentiary hearing.
Mr. Kelly, we
would rely on that.
You a couple times today and then numerous places in your brief, you referred to technical violations and you cited to the statute in reference to the filing of a complaint. would you agree that there is no case law to support? I'm presuming by that use of the word, you're making it synonymous with a minor violation, but would you agree that that statute has never been a basis for an Austin Motlin analysis? And in fact, our court, as recently as this fall, I believe it's the Smith decision, confirmed that any violation that's related to the type of offense in public safety is not a technical violation in that sense of being minor. And so would you agree that a requiring someone to abstain when they have a controlled substance is not a quote-unquote technical and or minor violation that would otherwise prohibit a court from exercising its discretion to revoke probation?
I would submit that by definition, it under the statute, it is a technical violation, but I don't know, I guess minor is a different term. And
well, isn't that what you meant by technical? You used it repeatedly, and I assume you were trying to at least imply the court abuses discretion when it sends someone on a technical violation.
Well, I think that the purpose of probation, in large part, when you're protecting public safety, is to avoid any kind of conduct which is then charged out as a crime. I think that that is certainly first and foremost. And knowing of the disease of chemical dependency in somebody who's on probation for 7 years, it'd be great if everybody was never relapsed. But we all know that's not going to happen. And so I think that the reason why the legislature used that term was because they do see it differently than, and they want courts to look at it differently than continuing criminal conduct in the way of charges or absconding. One other comment I'll make, I understand my time is up. One other comment I'll make is that when I routinely go to district courts and talk to probation officers at revocation hearings, if the defendant is being dishonest, it's a non-starter for the probation agent. How can I monitor someone who lies to me? So I think that it's unfair to say that, well, he's being honest, but we're not really crediting him for that. He shouldn't be credited for that. I think that that is a non-starter, and my client never crossed that line. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments today and for your briefs. This case is submitted.